Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Security Ledger podcast. I'm your host, Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In just the last decade, vehicles of all makes and models have been transformed from moderately intelligent, disconnected machinery to super sophisticated, internet-connected endpoints. Sensors and interactive features have sprouted like dandelions on automobiles, from Bluetooth-enabled entertainment systems to driver assistance technology that can literally steer the car on the highway or ease you into a parallel parking space. But security researchers, including Charlie Miller and Chris Valasek, have shown how the combination of internet connectivity and older, insecure networking protocols can combine to create potent attacks on connected cars. Vehicles sport some of the world's largest and most complex supply chains for both hardware and software. Those, too, are susceptible to compromise. What steps are car companies taking to address these issues? The Security Ledger sat down with Sameer Dixit to find out. He's the Senior Director of Security Consulting at Spirent, where he leads the ethical hacking and security research team called Spirent Security Labs. Spirent is a UK-based testing and measurement company that provides security consulting services, assessment, and monitoring to leading automakers. I started by asking Sameer to talk about the kinds of connectivity features his company is evaluating in the next generation of connected vehicles.
So we recently tested one of the bigger German automaker where they came up with this mobile application that could remotely control the car, like unlock a car, remotely start a car. Like we were able to kind of, we can steal anyone that make off the car by just knowing the VIN number. So
which is in the window, actually, I think, isn't it?
Exactly. Or you, if you're lazy like me and don't want to go to the window, you could actually search DMV. It's a publicly available information. So you could sit at your home and just unlock people's car if that's that model, or just have them start in the parking lot, all you need to do, and then just sit into it and drive. So that's one. Now, the other areas where we are seeing sort of development happening is autonomous driving, where you have next generation ADAS features that are self-assist parking. So we recently tested one of the major U.S. Automobile manufacturers that had one of the big tier one provide the ocular eye system, which assist in self-parking. Most of these self-parking features rely on, to kind of take a step back, rely on radar and LiDAR detection to kind of figure out exactly what is the distance left between the next car and yours, plus how far I am to the curb to help park itself. To do that, it does have an active communication to your steering, and it also have active channel open to all your pre-crash sensors, such as your seat belts. If it accidentally bumps itself into another car while doing that, all those safety features will come off. Now, the problem with this unique feature is, when it comes to security, is all that radar, LiDAR detection can be actually generated from far, far away, from sitting in my home for for a good 100 to 300 meters away. I could cause the car to feel that it is going to collide with something by just generating fake radar and LiDAR signals, which in turn could make it cause into a pre-crash condition. Like suppose if a car is moving onto a highway, right, at a good 50 to 60 miles an hour, and it's an autonomous vehicle with this fake images that you put in front of the car, it would feel that it's going to hit someone and apply the brakes really hard. There could be a big rig behind it, which would probably not be able to brake as swiftly as this autonomous car is, and that could cause an havoc. So we were able to actually reproduce this sort of an attack into when we tested this big U.S. automobile manufacturer, and we actually presented that research last year at DEF CON.
When you are analyzing these cars, how much access are you given by the customer? Are you allowed, are you given access to the source code itself? Or do you approach your testing like any hacker would, really, as, you know, this is a black box and we need to figure out how it works without the assistance of the manufacturer?
That environment sort of changes from customer to customer. Some customer comes to us and say, we want a true black box, what a hacker could do without the access to source code. We want to do what you can get out of it. In the example of this Ocular Eye system that we gave, that was a true black box. We were not giving any source code. We were not given even the make and model of that actual Ocular Eye system and say, see if you can attack it. Whereas in the previous one, that German auto car manufacturer, the connected app, we were actually given the app, not the source code itself, but we were given the usernames and passwords for it, so it was more of a gray box test. Now we are also working with some of the tier one manufacturers where they are developing next generation connected car infotainment unit, where they have given us the full bench as well as the source code and the APIs that are going to connect to cloud to do the real time over the air update. So it all depends on which use case the automobile manufacturer or tier one is going after, or what they have to pass to be compliant with the security guidance that has been given by the automobile manufacturer or by the National Highway Safety and Transport Administration or Department of Transportation.
Are there clear guidelines now for automakers and manufacturers around some of these issues?
It's a work in progress, right? I mean, just like 10 years back, 15 years back, when the whole application security industry started, and we were one of the companies that pioneered into that. We used to go to our customers and say, hey, you need application security. They're like, no, we don't need it. We have SSL. So it's more like that, right? I mean, the security industry itself is putting a spotlight into all those problems, and regulators like National Highway Safety Transportation Administration or Department of Transportation is trying to catch up with it, right? So there are other independent consortiums like SAE that are that have come out with some guidance on it. So it's not complete, but again, it's a work in progress.
We know from the work that Charlie Miller and Chris Valasek did that often compromises come by way of third-party suppliers. In that case, it was, you know, the head-end unit from Harman that provided access to the controller area network on the Jeep Cherokee. Is that pretty common in your experience? And how are manufacturers addressing the security of their very long supply chains, both hardware and software?
Yes, that's always going to be sort of like this cat and mouse race, right? Parts that are being manufactured by the OEM, they need to have a new mindset that vehicle manufacturers should have regarding the security of the connected vehicles. And also keep in mind, right, that nothing is hack-proof. There needs to be specific steps taken to kind of reduce the risk. Design changes needs to be made, because when those systems are designed, they were designed with the functionality in mind, but not security and functionality in mind. So security is sort of now what you are seeing is sort of bolted on top of it rather than baked into it. That mindset needs to change from both OEM and the consumer and the regulators have to push for all those things to be just like how you see it in your applications and networks and credit card payment systems, that there are strict guidelines on what needs to happen for you to be compliant. The same needs to happen on the OEM side and even from the auto manufacturer side.
I mean, one of the dynamics I've seen in other connected products industries, like connected toys and home appliances, is, you know, often you have the manufacturer of the underlying hardware product, and they want to add, let's say, a mobile app, as you were describing, you know, earlier. But that's not their specialty, and so they're going to outsource that to a mobile app development company. And often that is where the breakdown happens in security. You know, that mobile app development company, you know, maybe isn't used to developing an application for something as, you know, high value and potentially dangerous as a vehicle. So they don't use particularly high security standards in developing that application. And then the car maker, you know, they're not experts in mobile security. So they, in essence, don't know where to look for the problems, and that's how these things kind of find their way to market. Is that a dynamic that you're seeing? I mean, you told the story about the mobile application that, you know, anyone could hijack just with the VIN, you know. how does that happen, and where does the breakdown happen that something like that's even landing on your desk at Spirent?
We're sort of seeing it coming from both sides, right? When we are testing some of these stuff like that, isn't developed by an OEM who's sort of not an expert in software security or mobile application security, we are seeing some breakdowns from them. We are also seeing breakdowns from even the even on the architecture side too. So we are seeing the sort of the security as an afterthought in both. Once the application is completely developed, then it is going through penetration testing rather than starting on with the security architecture, then source code analysis, vulnerability assessment during production, and then a penetration testing. One of the examples I could give you from that same automobile manufacturer, right? When we reported the vulnerability, they're like, that's good. That does open our eyes into lots of these issues, but, you know, the vehicle is sort of already released with this features and functionality is already on, so we'll take care of it during next release cycle. And that next release cycle in an automobile could be anywhere between 6 to 1 year to 2 years. So it's that's the thing, right? In some cases, right, when it has implications or security implications on the actual hardware or on the actual firmware of your car or the infotainment systems in your car, then you actually have to bring the car back in, and or unless the car has the firmware FOTA is what we call it, firmware over the air update feature, then you have to actually bring do a recall on all those cars. So, and that's an expensive proposition as we know it.
I think people were really shocked to see, you know, Charlie Miller and Chris Valasek's demonstration, you know, driving a car off the highway via software-based attacks. How often is it in your research that you find cyber-physical attack vectors, in other words, software-based attacks that can literally affect the physical operation of the car if they were to be used in a real-world environment?
Often enough, especially on the cars that have some of these semi-autonomous features like self-driving, self-park features and all, those are all at risk because through our research, we have the other day we were testing one Japanese automobile manufacturer that has sent this firmware update over in USB. All it needed was for us to kind of retract that firmware from that USB, put a tricked out firmware back onto that USB, and stick that USB into the USB port in the infotainment system to have control over features and functionalities that my car did not come with when I did a standard purchase. With that same thing, right, I mean, this is the brains of your car. If you're able to fiddle with that brain, you could make it do various nasty things that it's not designed or that it should do.
So final question, you raised a really good point earlier, which was that, you know, cars have very long lifespans. You know, I'm driving around a 2003, you know, Honda Odyssey minivan, right? So it's 14 years old and running great. But, you know, in the technology industry, we are not used to supporting devices, whether those are laptops or mobile phones, for 14 years. What is your sense about how car manufacturers plan to support these types of software features over that time span? And also, what are you seeing with how they plan to do things like deprovision connected vehicles when they change hands, you know, getting sensitive data from one owner off and putting another owner in charge of the vehicle, those types of issues?
So that's a loaded question. So let me first start off saying, if you're using a 2003 Odyssey, that's actually a very secure vehicle.
Right.
You still use the key to start it. So yeah, I have a 2002 myself with a stick shift. So I mean, you should definitely hold on to those ones. Those are one of the secure ones. One of the things that you will definitely see in the industry is a shift. Currently, the cars that you and I are using, unfortunately or fortunately, is that it does not. We don't really get too many recalls on that. We don't really have to take our cars for regular software updates and things like that. The next generation connected cars will definitely see many more of these frequent updates, either through you have if it's a complete overhaul or a write-up of a software, you might actually have to take your car into the dealership, something that's very heavy and cannot be done simultaneously on thousands of or hundreds and thousands of running car of that make and model over the air. For those, you might have to take them. But you will see lots of these over-the-air updates. The firmware over-the-air update will play a very critical role, both in updating the software on a regular basis and enabling and disabling some of the car features and functionalities. And every time a car changes hands from one user to another, a refresh of a system, because there are lots of privacy concerns too, because next-generation connected cars store a lot of your private and sensitive information because of all the browsing history that you will have, all the Facebooks and your bank and bank applications, etc., connections into your car. There is your whole environment is around you, moving with you in a car. That needs to be sleek, clean, just like when you send your mobile device or sell your old mobile device, there is a reset button. There's a more of that will happen in the next generation automated vehicle. The other question that you asked, which was very important and interesting one, was like, how will this all play out with the existing cars that are in play? For those ones, I don't see a way. I mean, if my car doesn't have a over-the-air update functionality, so they would probably have to either give me a new one, or there needs to be some added on OEM features that needs to be bolted on top of it and then be managed parallelly by automotive partners or divisions of automotive that just focuses on the existing cars, making those dumb cars the smart cars.
Sameer Dixit of Spirent Security Labs, thank you so much for calling in and talking to the Security Ledger podcast.
Thanks for inviting me, and pleasure to be here.